Session 6, Thoreau's Cynicism. How does departing from everyday life allow you to return to yourself, to be yourself, in ways that defy convention and habit, in ways that allow you to be at once free and in touch? It's very easy to think that experience is a perfectly personal matter, that mindfulness always has to refer to my mind exclusively in all of its questionable integrity. But experience, for worse yet mostly for better, has a great deal to do with the way that we take in the social and cosmic order. Experience would mean next to nothing if it was just something had by me in perfect isolation. Experience, thankfully, isn't even just a two-way affair, a kind of monogamous relationship between myself and the objects of my perception. The reality of experience is far more complex. The angle of vision that each of us enjoys and suffers can take in a whole field of sensible life. Its foreground, its background, its center, periphery, its sources and destination. And this has everything and absolutely nothing to do with you and me. Now, if this seems like a philosopher pontificating or vacillating for no good reason, I assure you that is not my intent. What I'm trying to say is this: experience has a strange character, perfectly singular and forcibly, absolutely not. We all have experience about almost everything, and that makes all the difference. Now, in this session, we're not going to focus, at least immediately, on the transcendent nature of experience. We might get there, but no promises and not right away. Let's be patient. Instead, I want to talk about our experience of the social and political order and our unique, often difficult responses to it. I have to be honest. More often than not, when I listen to the radio or watch the grinding 24-hour news cycle, I am thoroughly disgusted. This is an experience too. And I would be rather remiss in a series on self-transcendence and experience to avoid talking about this disgust as well. Experience happens in our social sphere, and we need to remember that. Henry David Thoreau experienced this sort of dissatisfaction with our social experience deeply. The sense that society and politics was in some obvious conspiracy against our senses, tactile, moral, and otherwise. And his experience of the social sphere drove him to take action, which is what I would like to talk with you today. Henry David Thoreau, like me and maybe you, found himself deeply disgusted with the social and political sphere. He felt it was in some sort of conspiracy against our senses, tactile, moral, and otherwise. And his experience of this social sphere drove him to take action, which is what I would like to talk to you about today. Thoreau, who was born a little more than two centuries ago, was arguably the first and most thoroughgoing American cynic. And there is at least a family resemblance between the cynicism of today and the philosophy that Thoreau developed in the 1840s. What do I mean by cynicism? It is the idea, based on experience, that the present-day civilized world does not enliven the senses, cultivate our personalities, or foster our higher desires, but rather leads in the opposite direction, to an ever narrower understanding of ourselves, to the curtailing of noble ambitions, and the squandering of our potentials. Thoreau's cynicism was grounded in his youth, when he began to cultivate a lifelong disdain for the liberal elitist window dressing of New England. He attended Harvard, but only begrudgingly, and the snobbery of academia grated on this son of a pencil maker. He quickly came to the position that universities, even the best ones, might teach, in his words, all of the branches of learning, but none of the roots. Deep education, the lessons that actually stick, are, according to Thoreau, practical, hands-on, and best learned in the world beyond the classroom, beyond civilization. When Thoreau escaped to Walden Pond, 2 miles from his native Concord in 1845, it was, at least in part, in search of this sort of education. Thoreau was also on a quest to embody the most Emersonian of ideals, self-reliance. Emerson, Thoreau's mentor and 7 years his senior, had also taken issue with the high intellectual culture of Harvard and Cambridge and argued that there was often a very high price of admission to modern institutions and organizations, namely, the freedom to exercise one's autonomy. Thoreau's apparent separation from society, his move away from city life, was to attempt, in Thoreau's words, to live deliberately, to front the essential facts of life, and to see if he could not learn what it had to teach. The point of his 2-year experiment with simple living was to see what life could be like without the corrupting forces of social conventions and traditional politics. All of this is consonant with a long history of cynicism. But as one looks closer at this history, the history of cynicism, and Thoreau, it becomes clear that we modern cynics truncate, or pointedly misunderstand, the full scope of the tradition, the full scope of cynicism as a school of thought. The first cynic, Diogenes of Sinope, epitomized the ideal of simplicity that Thoreau sought to revive in the 19th century. At Walden, Thoreau lived in a 10-by-15-foot boarded cabin. Diogenes, by contrast, lived in an overturned barrel, clothed only in rags. He stood against another school of philosophy known as Epicureanism, and this school believed that the meaning of life could be grasped in, I don't know, let's call it the opulence of civilization. The cynic, however, remained enduringly unconvinced. What would life be like without societal constraints, but also, and more importantly, without all the trappings of material wealth? This was the question of the cynic. And this is the question that thinkers like Thoreau and then Emerson wanted to answer. Today, many so-called cynics are also, somewhat ironically, self-reliant capitalists. What do I mean by this? Those individuals who are suspicious of institutions often turn to capitalism in the way of the dollar as a certain touchstone or watchword. These individuals, these cynics, have suspicions about big government and institutional control, and their suspicions are rooted in the sense that institutions may cheat individuals out of the riches to which they are entitled. Of course, this idea would have been anathema to Thoreau or Diogenes, who would have believed that the modern age had erred grievously in confusing material wealth with human prosperity writ large. According to legend, Diogenes would sit in his barrel and bark at wealthy pedestrians. The word cynic comes from the Greek word meaning dog. Thoreau took a slightly more subtle approach to criticizing modern capitalism, but really only slightly. The first chapter of Walden is entitled Economy, and this is a spirited critique of modern materialism. The term economy, Thoreau reminds his readers, was not originally about what one possessed as surplus, but rather where, or more specifically, or how, one lived. Thoreau traces economy back to the Greek word oikos, which simply meant to dwell, to habitate, to live in. At Walden, by divesting himself of life's excesses, Thoreau attempts to relearn what went into making a place for oneself and appreciating the priceless things of life, virtue, beauty, and peace, those things that money can't buy. Thoreau writes, "Most of the luxuries and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only an indispensable, but positive hindrances to the elevation of mankind." Today, making a living often has nothing to do with life itself, but rather, and disturbingly, its deferral, a sacrificing of the present moment for the sake of future wealth. Thoreau knows that oikos has another meaning beyond dwelling or home. It can also mean to feel caged in. Thoreau's apparent escape to the outskirts of civilization might look like it anticipates the separatist mindset of many modern cynics, but this isn't exactly right. As Robert Richardson noted nearly 30 years ago in his biography of Thoreau, Thoreau's venture was in no sense a retreat or withdrawal. He himself thought of it as a step forward, a liberation, a new beginning. Cynicism maintains its distance from society in order to gain a new critical vantage point on social ills, but also, and just as importantly, to reevaluate what is most personally significant and universally true about human life. When Diogenes was asked about his country of origin, he famously claimed not to have one. This is not unlike Thoreau's refusal to participate in or pay taxes to a state whose policies he could not endorse. In this case, Thoreau famously refused to support the collection of monies in support of the nationalist campaign in the Mexican-American War. In a barrel, in a shanty shack, in a prison, in the middle of nowhere, one gets the very real sense that, existentially speaking, they are not bound to any particular locus or place. This can be quite isolating and sort of incarcerating, but also liberating and ultimately, rather surprisingly, unifying. When Diogenes was asked about his origins, he replied that he hailed from no particular polis or city-state. He was instead a citizen of the cosmos at large. He was a cosmopolitan. This is the other largely forgotten side of cynicism. The suspicion of all things organized gives way to the belief that human beings are, in fact, deeply and universally related, tied together not by convention, but by nature and by experience. Institutions may be corrupt and corrupting, but this cosmopolitanism suggests that the true danger of societal constraints is that they isolate individuals and place false boundaries between cultural groups. The critical or negative aspect of cynicism is the other side of hope, a hope for a community of experience that transcends any particular provincial loyalty. The life of simplicity that the cynic endorses downplays the traditional attachments one has in life, our commitments to religion, economics, politics as usual, and in so doing, it frees us to realize the bonds that exist beyond these self-imposed borders. Which brings us back to experience. Our disgust with certain aspects of its form, with the sense that life is wasted in some experiences and realized in others, is often very instructive or even revelatory. When we retreat from one world of experience, like the social sphere we live in or the cultural conventions under which we find ourselves, when we remove ourselves from those, we find ourselves. We might catch sight of something else which undoubtedly exceeds those bounds.